Today we continue our series on the parables of Jesus. This week I read where someone described preaching, what I do on a weekly basis, as the fine art of talking in someone else's sleep. Now I'm not sure that's true, I hope that's not true. But I do know that one of the occupational hazards of being a preacher is lost attention. But I do take some consolation in understanding this, that I'm not alone. Even the fact when our Lord Jesus was here on earth, there were those in his congregation, the people that he was preaching to, who listened to him preach, but did not really hear what he had to say. And I think one of those factors that we find is this, that our obsessions with worldly priorities keeps us from really hearing what Jesus has to say. And one of those instances happened in the 12th chapter of Luke, where Jesus is preaching to a huge multitude. He's talking to them about life and death, about hypocrisy and hell. And he's telling them about the love of God and the fear of God. But as Jesus was moving through his sermon, a man elbowed his way, probably to the front of where Jesus was speaking. And in the middle of the sermon, this man interrupted Jesus and said this, "Teacher, divide the inheritance between me and my brother." Now, he was talking to them about life and death and hypocrisy and hell and other things and fear and love of God. But in the middle of this, if you see what happened, in the middle of this sermon, something happened. This gentleman worked his way to the front of the crowd to ask Jesus a question about one of his obsessions with his worldly priorities. It seems that this gentleman, father probably died, and now he and his brother were squabbling over the estate. I think there's probably no bitterness in life, at least what I've experienced and seen and witnessed, the bitterness of sibling bitterness at the end of life. It can be difficult. But one thing is certain, this man had this issue at the center of his life. For him, the birds would never sing again, the flowers would never bloom again, and the sun would never shine again until somehow, some way, he got what he thought was his fair share. It was this obsession that kept him from really hearing what Jesus had to say. I mean, you think about there. There he was standing in the presence of God, the God of heaven, and his mind was fixed on gold. And Jesus turned to him and said, "Man, who made me a judge or divider over you?" Now, it seems like an odd question coming from Jesus. What Jesus seems to be suggesting is this: you somehow think that I have come to settle the disputes between two warring brothers. And maybe that's what Jesus came for. It seems like this gentleman wanted Jesus to judge and divide. And Jesus, at this moment, refuses to do that. Now, he's not saying that judging and dividing are wrong. He knows that there's disputes that have to be settled. He was simply, I think, making a statement of this. He was saying, "That is not why I came. And, sir, you missed the point of my sermon." And I thought about that. And I think about a lot of times that we give certain reasons of why Jesus came. I mean, some of us would probably admit that we tell others that Jesus came to be a teacher, to teach us things and to give us principles. And that if we listen to what Jesus teaches us, then we could just settle the disputes among us, among nations about men and women, and things would be okay. But we see that hasn't quite exactly panned out. There's others who maybe say that, oh, Jesus is different. Jesus came to be an example. And maybe that was some of the reasons why years ago with a WWJD bracelet became popular. What would Jesus do? What would be his example? Maybe then, if we figured that out, maybe then some of the disputes, the animosities would be settled. But I think what Jesus maybe is suggesting to us, that he didn't come to be just a teacher. He didn't come to just be an example. Jesus came to bring God to man and man to God. He did not come, as much as we maybe think at times, to make bad people better or good people even just a little bit better. I think what Jesus was suggesting in this parable, as he talking about different parts in this sermon before he got interrupted, is that Jesus came for men and women who are spiritually dead and could now become alive. Anything short of that is missing the reason for Jesus' coming. So Jesus says then, beware of covetousness, for a man does not consist of things he possesses. Now I have to admit to you that that word covetousness is just sort of an old-fashioned word. It's kind of out of date. I'm not sure it even really applies to us these days. It's kind of lost its cutting edge that was there in the King James Version and people talking about the Ten Commandments. I mean, it could even be suggested that when God was making the Ten Commandments, he only came up with 9. And he's like, man, I need a 10th one. What can I do? Where can I find the 10th commandment? You know what? Why don't we just throw in covetousness? And somehow, we don't really think that covetousness maybe is that much of a sin. Maybe just God just threw that one in at the end to make it a perfect 10 commandments. But what we find out, this covetousness is not outdated. It's as real today as it has been any other time as this world has existed. And this word covetousness, though it's overused and has a religious word to it, is simply this: craving more of what you already have enough of. And what Jesus is saying is that that is not life. Life does not consist of things that you possess. See, Jesus, in that moment, in that sermon, to the multitude of those crowds, was dealing with the same kind of voices that we have today. These seductive voices that keep ringing in our society, that keep pounding at us, that keep helping us to form who we are. And that word is striving, striving, getting more, more, and we hear it. Several years ago, I almost didn't even mention this illustration, but several years ago, almost embarrassed to admit it, and I want to confess this to the church this morning, but please don't let it outside this room. Dawn and I somehow reluctantly, and I will say Dawn even more reluctantly, in fact, she moaned and groaned about this, we attended with some friends in Florida a Greyhound dog races. I'm sorry, I just confessed. Okay? And we went there. One time and one time only. And Dawn moaned the whole way through. I was just trying to be friendly, okay, with other people. And one thing about those dog races is I was sitting there and watching race after race as they bring these greyhound dogs in and put them in an area like they do horses. And then they open the gates and these dogs run. And the thing about those dog races is I keep thinking about that day. Is that each time that dog, when it came out of that chute, would look at something that was just outside of its reach. It was like a windsock of a rabbit or something that was tied to the long side of the track. And that lure, that rabbit, that stuffed windsock thing that was there, was always just beyond the reach of the dog. And those dogs would race out, and they would see that, and they would run around that track as fast as they could. And of course, the object was who would win the race. And I kept thinking to myself, you dumb dogs. How many times can you be put in that cage, looking at that stuffed lure rabbit, and chase that thing time after time after time? And they've never catch it. And I'm like, I'm just waiting for one time in this race that a dog, when they opened it up, the dog just sat there and said, nope, not going to do it. Nope, been there, done that. But it never happens. The dogs never give up. Each race is a promise. A promise to get the prize, but what it promises, it does not deliver. When we acquire things, believing that they will satisfy, we discover that we're still empty. But it doesn't mean we stop, it just means we readjust. But on we go, worried about all kinds of things. And Jesus says, beware of covetousness, beware of craving more and more of what you already have enough of. And then to drive home that lesson, Jesus tells a story about a man who has made his money in agriculture. And I want us to look at that parable this morning to be up on the screen. It's Luke 12, 16 to 21, and it says this. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what should I do? I have no place to store all of these crops. And then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store more surplus grain. And then I will say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years, so take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then you will get what you have prepared for yourself. This is how it will be with whoever stores up for those things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. So here we have Jesus in the middle of the story, and had an interruption at the beginning of the, in the middle of the sermon, and then Jesus, off of that, tells a story. A parable about a wealthy farmer. We don't know his name. We don't know his background. But evidently in this story, he was someone that the community people could relate to. People would feel like he was a success. And we are constantly measuring people by what they have rather than what they are. Now, don't misunderstand me. And I have to say this every time because I know growing up, I had this image in my head, and I'm trying to get this image out of my head because I grew up with this understanding in the church, which is wrong. And that is this, that riches in and of themselves are not evil. Because what tends to happen in the church, and what happened when I grew up was, we always looked to our left, someone who had better means than we did, and we put them in the rich category. And that no matter how high we went up in the chain of wealth and what that looked like, we always seemed we looked to the next step up and said that's who the rich people were. And I think if Jesus heard that, he would say, no, 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 you're missing the point. You're missing my intent. See, some of God's great men and women were people of means. Abraham was very wealthy. Job, after all of his suffering, God rewarded him with great wealth. David and Solomon were wealthy kings. In the early church, we see examples of these communities that would come together, and these wealthier people would invite people into their home to have these worship services. So wealth in and of itself is not evil. But now as I flip it to the other side and say this, for every verse in the Bible that tells us the benefits of wealth and we see how that works, there are 10 of them probably that tell us of the danger of wealth. For wealth and money has, and gold has a way of binding us to what is physical and temporal, blinding us to what is spiritual and eternal. Now, as we read this story in the parable, we read a story about someone who has done well. And the Bible commends industry. And what we know about this wealthy farmer is that he was industrious, that he made money in agriculture. Now, I don't know a whole lot about agriculture, but I do know this. In Agriculture 101, it usually takes hard work and the sweat on your brow to make a living farming. Lands do not plant themselves, and harvests do not gather themselves. And so the Bible commends hard work. The Bible commends industry. Because we also read in the Bible in other areas, if you decide you're going to take life easy and be a sluggard, the Bible has some words to say about that. But there's also danger in industry. You can work hard and never ask, what am I working for? You can spend your strength and your time and your life and never pause to say, what is the purpose of my life? See, his problem in the parable was this, was no longer growth or production. It was storage. He was going to pull down his old barns and put up new ones. And we admire progress in society. The only trouble is that sometimes progress gets confused with only about things and progress a little bit less about people. Years ago, there was a missionary in Africa by the name of Dan Crawford. He's returning from Africa to go back to the United States one time. And to do so, he would be leaving the inner part of the country where he had worked and ministered to many people. But he had to go out to the coast to catch the ship. He didn't want to make the trip alone, so he took four of the people that he was ministering to walk along with him as he headed to the coast. As they walked, Dan Crawford told his friends about the glorious beauty of the coast. He told them about the light that did not have flame, about a wagon that did not have animals, and about storing their food so that it would not spoil. As he walked and he talked, three of the men entered into conversation with him. But the fourth man strangely seemed unimpressed. And after a few days and many conversations, they were sitting around one evening. Dan Crawford found it irritating. This one man did not seem all excited about getting to the city. So he finally confronted the man. He says, hey, what's going on? Aren't you eager to get there? I mean, don't you want to see all these things? That black brother responded with a word that I wish could be integrated in our own hearts. And he said this, Mr. Crawford, to be better off is not to be better. As I think about that story, if we live to collect riches as though God does not exist, he says we are a fool. In Jesus' story, talking about this farmer, it was too late that he discovered the obvious. There's no boxes in a casket. He had built barns and fed donkeys and not given much thought about God. Now, let me just pause. I believe in the story that he probably was a religious person. He probably believed that God existed. But the disconnect seemed to be he didn't actually believe that God existed in his own life and for his own purposes. And so God says, you're a fool. Then the haunting question that he poses, who shall these things be by which you have provided? And I go back and we pause there. I go back to the beginning of the story, to this interruption of Jesus' sermon, back to the two people who were quarreling over the inheritance. And I don't know if there's a connection, but to me there seems to be a connection between these two fighting over their inheritance and this one who had all these things and it was taken away from him. It seems that maybe the story does connect, and I don't know if it does, but it seems like this man maybe had these two sons were part of that. And the story suggests that maybe for both of them, the two brothers that were fighting, and also for the landowner, that they both were fools. I don't know. You can read into that what you like. But I think what it does suggest is this. An illustration I think best describes is when you play chess. People play chess. When I was younger, I played a lot more chess than I do today. But one thing interesting about chess is this. There are many different pieces in the game of chess. And each one has a different power and can maneuver itself in different ways. But here's what's interesting. I used to get frustrated in chess. I got checkmate more times than I even want to think about. And I was frustrated because I forgot about the maneuver that some people could do. But I know at the end of that game, when the chess game was over, all those pieces were put back into the same box. And that's true with our lives. You see, you can play the game, you can play against the system or with the system. The system, you may say, is beating you, or you may beat the system. You may be jumped by some and others jumped by others, but the reality is at the end of the game, the game is over, and the pieces are put back into the box. What Jesus is saying is this, when you measure what you give your life to, is it worth your life to get what you're after? You amass things and you leave them behind. Is it worth living for? And Jesus says you ought to be concerned about living your life for this other kingdom, not our kingdom, this kingdom of God. And he presses upon that more and more in each parable that we hear. And Jesus says that is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself and is not rich towards God. Now, I hear this phrase, rich towards God. What does that mean? How does that work in our own lives? I think the answer is maybe in our own lives, you have to decide that God will have all of you. That whatever else you do, your life will be centered on him. As we heard the song and we sung the song, Jesus, be the center. Be my life. And the answer in some places in our lives is that you have to decide that God is going to have all of you. And Jesus drives that point home, and not in all the parables, but we see an extension of this parable when he says this, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or about your body, what you will wear, for life is more than food and the body more than clothes. Don't make that the focus of your life. And then he gives two illustrations to drive home this point. The first one is this. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn. Yet God feeds them. And how much more valuable are you than birds? Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little, why do you worry about the rest? And then the second one, he goes on and he talks about the lilies. And he says this, consider how the lilies, the wild flowers grow. They do not labor or spin, yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and gone tomorrow, is thrown into the fire, how much more we clothe you, you of little faith. Now, when we hear these words and we say, okay, it's another preacher saying these things again about that, and you know, the problem with preachers these days is this, that sometimes they're not realists. They preach this word and somehow think that we can do this, but they don't understand my life. I say, well, God is a realist, and God does understand your life, and he knows you have to pay the rent. He knows you have to buy groceries. He's not saying don't think about those things. He's just saying don't worry about them. Don't make them the aim of your life. If you're going to worry, worry about something important. Then he says these words, but seek first his kingdom. First his kingdom. Not our kingdom, not our chess game. Seek first his kingdom, and then all these things will be given to you as well. I think back to that March evening several years ago, back to the Greyhound dog races. I was fascinated by everything about that and what that looked like and how that relates to our lives. And I thought about that night and that evening, and one thing came to mind, and it was this. Perhaps one thing worse than getting what you desire is getting what you desire and discovering you didn't want it at all. A windsock looking like a rabbit just outside of our reach, hoping and praying that one day, like a dog or our own lives, that we will be able to reach out and get what we've been striving for. And so the sad part, the reality part is this, that maybe worse than getting what you strive for is getting what you strive for and discovering it, you didn't want it after all. What you put at the center of your life determines the spokes of your life. Jesus, be the center. If that happens, the rest of life, no matter what comes your way, will take care of itself. Do you believe that?